Hello, and welcome to Microbe Talk, the podcast from the Microbiology Society. Today's episode is going to be the second of our podcast series, Domino Effect, where microbiologists are interviewed by other Microbiology Society members that they haven't met before. You might remember the first episode of Domino Effect from January, where Dr. Lena Sirik interviewed Dr. Paul Hoskisson. If you haven't heard it yet, I'd definitely recommend going back to listen to it after this episode. It's great fun.
My name's Sarah Jones, and I'm a PhD student studying geomicrobiology.
I'm Lena Sirik. I'm an associate professor in environmental engineering at UCL.
This month, it's Lena's turn in the hot seat.
So I was going to start at the very beginning. When did you know you wanted to be a microbiologist?
Do you know what? I didn't. It wasn't really something I was particularly interested in until I dabbled in it. I did a biology degree, and we did do microbes, but I wasn't overly excited by them at that time. And then after I finished my degree, I got a research assistant job. And it was then I didn't really realize what science was until I actually did it in the lab.
Did you not have much sort of practical work in your undergraduate degree?
We did, but it didn't feel like you were asking a question. It felt like you were just following a recipe. So yeah. It wasn't like, you know, I had a question and then I thought, oh, well, how am I going to answer this question? Let's set up these experiments, blah, 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 which is like the full story. At uni, it felt a little bit like you were only doing a tiny bit of that process.
You're right, yeah, when you do practical work, unless it's a project of your own design, you're not really invested.
Well, you sort of go through the motions, don't you? You do it, but it's not.
And you're not finding out anything new, you're just...
No, sort of, it's like, oh, there's a band on a gel. Woo!
Yeah, you're literally rediscovering the wheel.
Yeah.
Did you always plan to stay in academia? I'm guessing not.
No, I had no idea, really. I was quite an arty kid, and I always thought I'd do something creative, but then once I was at school, and I was quite good at maths and the sciences, it was the natural way to go. And at one point, I wanted to be an architect because I thought it's like a nice combo of maths and creative things, but that never sort of came to fruition. It was really when I started this research assistant job. After that, I always wanted to do something in science, but I wasn't sure whether I'd be able to stay in academia or I'd go into industry or what.
So do you think, as an associate professor based in the Faculty of Engineering,
yes,
what are some of the advantages of working in a kind of faculty that isn't necessarily a biological one?
I guess I've always been really interested in applied research. I feel like engineering is sort of translating scientific discoveries into something useful. So it's quite a nice place to be in because, you know, you might make a discovery and then you'll know people that can then make it into something useful or translate it in some way into, I don't know, a machine. They have a very much a can-do attitude, which is really handy. The other thing that has been good is that I'm quite exotic to the engineers. So, you know, I'm like the go-to microbiologist. But what I don't have is, you know, colleagues who have a similar background to me to bounce ideas off and stuff. And Sometimes I don't feel so confident about some of the things I'm asked because, you know, I clearly no one can know the whole of microbiology, but people seem to think that because you say you're a microbiologist, you are like the encyclopedia of microbiology.
I think that's to do with films, isn't it? There's always like films where there's a scientist that knows all of
everything.
Science for some reason.
Yes.
How did it come about? Were the engineering department looking for a microbiologist to
join? Yeah, so they were interested in looking at healthy spaces and air quality and how pollutants, including microbes, move within a space. It's a really diverse department, and civil engineering isn't just making roads and making bridges and making tower blocks or whatever. It's about making a good environment for people to live in and for the world, not just for people, I guess.
To some extent, you've got back to your original aim of wanting to work in architecture. And
Yeah, I quite like it. And do you know what? I also feel like there was a time when I felt like that my job wasn't creative at all, but actually it is quite creative because I think you do, you know, it's all of the sort of ideas about coming up with the questions and with the hypotheses and then coming up with solution or experiments that you can do to answer those questions. But then there are also other aspects of the job that perhaps weren't available before, like, for example, doing this podcast, you know, or, you know, doing public engagement stuff or working with the media or, you know, I don't know, designing flyers and things. So I think I guess the job is sort of what you make of it.
You jointly won the Provost's Public Engagement Award this year.
Yes, yes.
Could you tell us a bit more about the engagement projects you've been
involved? Yeah, of course. I've always been really interested in doing public engagement and outreach activities as well. The project that we won the prize for is a sort of, it's something that we've been working on for a few years. So it's with my colleague Hui from the Bartlett. We were interested in this idea of a compost toilet, and she was interested in people's opinions about such a toilet. You know, would they want to use it? Would they think that the compost was really disgusting and like a biohazard? Mm-hmm. And then I was interested in the microbial safety of it, but also the composting process itself and the nutrients that you get out the other end and stuff. So it was a nice pairing. It's a commercial compost toilet that we've installed at Spitalfields City Farm. Within the toilet cubicle, we wanted to sort of have some information for users about, you know, why it's useful, how it works. So we ran some workshops with primary school kids and with some teenagers as well who visit the farm, some corporate social responsibility groups that had come from the city, which is very near Spitalfields City Farm, and then also some Bangladeshi gardeners who use the farm to grow their own produce. So we sort of distilled that with an artist into an artwork, which has been painted onto the inside of the toilet. So,
oh, that's so great.
Yeah, it's really cool. We should go and have a look at it and make a deposit. and now we're going to be collecting samples and interviewing people, catching them as they come out the loop. So, was that good?
Would the idea be that it could be used in a greater variety of buildings in the future?
I don't know. I mean, this particular toilet is made for areas where the ground is really rocky, so you can't get the water infrastructure there, or the sewage infrastructure.
So is it compost entirely made of human waste, or is it sort of a mixture?
It's a bit of a mixture, so usually you'll put in some stuff like sawdust or something like that to sort of break it up a bit, but also it needs some sort of drying to be taking place, and often the urine is diverted to elsewhere so that so it's not so wet, so it dries quicker. And
I wonder if there's a way to use the recycled urine for like,
well,
nitrogen.
The urine has most of the has most of the nutrients, but the poo has the like the structure.
Yeah.
You know.
I know Thames Water makes like biosolids.
Like, yeah. Well, I think like a massive like 90% or something of treated sewage sludge gets put onto agricultural land.
Are you looking to do any other engagement projects into the future?
We've been working on one which has been a real success. It's like probably the most successful thing I have ever done, even though it's not very exciting science. We've been running this stall called How Clean Is Your Phone?
Oh no.
Yes. So we first ran it at the Science Museum Lates, and then it's been so popular that we've run it another couple of times here, and they've asked us to do it again. So basically, yeah, people come with their phone and we get them to swab it. We gave each person or each phone like an identifier, and then it could log in a few days later to see what we found.
Oh, that's so cool.
It was really good. I love it. It's brilliant.
Like, I'd want to see it, but also it would be horrifying.
I know. I was sort of disappointed that my phone wasn't that gross. But actually, do you know what? The grossest phones seem to be from people who work in healthcare.
Ooh. Oh, that is not reassuring.
No, it's not. No, where have they been?
Although it is this kind of modern discussion that comes up a lot, where they sort of say 8 billion fecal bacteria found on the tube, or there's so much poo on a McDonald's touchscreen. And it does make you wonder, how much does it matter if we're constantly touching?
Well, it can't, I mean, you know, I don't think, it's clearly not having a massive impact on people's lives.
Yeah.
Plus, you know, just because you find an E. coli doesn't mean it came from someone's bum.
Do you think it needs to be part of a bigger picture of education, where in school we should be teaching too?
Of course. I mean, I think we should be teaching kids. I have a 5-year-old. They've been looking at, they did frogs, they've had a chicken, they've had some chicks in there. But I don't see why they shouldn't do, you know, microbes, all the microbes around you, because they're everywhere around them. They're on them, they're in them, they're on the stuff around them. They're constantly swapping between each other.
Yeah.
So it would be great if, you know, everyone just knew that they were a vessel for microbes.
And that's not necessarily a bad thing.
No. This is what it's always been like. They've shaped us and we've shaped them. It's just how it is.
I saw you do the talk at the inaugural Micro at UCL symposium about kind of reducing pathogens in the built environment. And you were talking about antimicrobial materials.
Yes.
And I've written, so cool about that. So, yeah, what sort of got you thinking about making antimicrobial materials?
I work quite a lot with hospitals. People are constantly trying to sell them antimicrobial curtains, antimicrobial everything. It's a funny one for me as well, because I don't think generally antimicrobial whatever kills everything. And I don't think we should be striving for a sterile environment. So I sort of have mixed feelings about the antimicrobial work that I do, because it's indiscriminate. Yeah. But I guess it was that need or the push in hospitals to, you know, be really on top of the infection control and stuff. They have many more of the antibiotic resistant bugs. So the antimicrobial materials that we've worked with are usually, it's usually like a normal material that you then impregnate with something antimicrobial. So we've fiddled with some fairly standard dyes, which if you mix with gold nanoparticles seem to have a much better activity against microbes. And we've also used metallic nanoparticles within filters.
A while back there was like a moratorium on nanoparticles.
Yeah.
Is that still the case?
Yeah, it is. I think it is pretty much still the case. I mean, there's still a lot of work happening mm-hmm. with them. I mean, personally, I am a bit scared of metallic nanoparticles generally, because they are toxic, you know, to microbes, but also to all other living things. So it's possibly not the best solution for the future.
One of the questions I was going to ask was, as a PhD student, I'm quite interested to hear what it's like from the other side. So obviously you've experienced both being a PhD student and being a supervisor.
All of the different bits that I've done have been really different. So being a research assistant was actually maybe the most similar to being a postdoc, because you are given a project to work on and you have a bit of freedom to, you know, take it in a particular way or do an experiment in a particular way, but really you're there to do a job. So between being a research assistant and being a postdoc, I was a PhD student, and it was a more emotive experience. So because, you know, the project is very much yours and it's your baby and you sort of live and breathe it for those years with the highs and the lows. Mm-hmm. But then going from postdoc to an academic was a massive gear change. So, you know, I can't remember the last time I was in the lab. You know, it's probably safer that I don't go in the lab. I don't know where anything is. I don't know how anything works. But I guess I've learned much more about communicating effectively through, you know, I guess writing more or correcting other people's papers, or, you know, talking at conferences, meeting various collaborators, applying for grants and stuff. My academic life is very much about getting money and then about supervising the research of other people. And then there's the teaching, which is, you know, the whole new world, but is, you know, fairly enjoyable aside from things like marking and student complaints.
How do you go about balancing all of those elements? Do you just sort of have a go and
It is definitely difficult, and, you know, having a family also adds another level of complexity to it all, because it's not, you know, I can't stay around forever. I need to go and pick up my son. And also the time then when I'm at home, I want to spend with him and with my husband, not, you know, writing grant proposals. So, yeah, it's difficult. It's a difficult juggling act. But I think, I don't know, it feels like any job is these days.
Yeah.
If for no other reason that you're constantly, like, battling with emails coming in while trying to work.
Do you ever miss being more into just researching?
Yeah, I miss it a lot. I guess now it's a lot, my job now is a lot more varied, but it was really nice to just get your teeth into a set of experiments and, like, do the troubleshooting and get your results and analyze them and stuff. So it was
crying because it doesn't work.
Yeah, exactly. I miss, you know, just that was my focus was getting some experiments done, analyze, getting the results and then doing the next thing. And, you know, perhaps I'd be writing a paper or I'd go to a conference to present something, but there wasn't any of this other teaching stuff and trying to get money and, you know, schmoozing industry and all of the other things, which are also enjoyable. It's just that it feels like about five jobs in one.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder if academia is unique in that way. It must be one of the jobs that has the most diversity of jobs fed into one job.
Yeah. I mean, it's also the wonderful thing about it.
So if you hadn't got into being a scientist, what else would you have chosen to do?
I can't say for sure, but I have been thinking, in moments of darkness where I've had enough of academia, I wonder about what I could be doing instead. And I quite like the idea of being like a furniture builder or something, because it's got some sort of maths and measurements, but also a creative side. Mm-hmm. And you make something useful, so yeah. But also beautiful. So I like the idea of that. But, you know, who knows, maybe one day.
And that's all we have time for this month. Thanks so much for listening, and a huge thanks to Lena and Sarah for being on the podcast for this episode. This won't be the last you'll hear from Sarah, since next time on Domino Effect, it'll be her turn to be interviewed. If you'd be interested in taking part in a future episode, email me at l.cox@microbiologysociety.org. I've been Laura, and thanks for listening to Microbe Talk.